If you looked at the White House press release for this trip last month, the headline for this was, quote, President Bush to travel to Middle East to follow up on progress made at Annapolis. That was the headline. It didn't say anything about going to the Gulf in the headline. You had to read down into the small print to find the rest of the president's itinerary. To the best of my understanding, this is precisely opposite from the way the trip came about. This is a Gulf trip, born from what I have, from what I believe to be the case, born originally of Vice President Cheney's trip to Saudi Arabia last year, and given greater impetus by the reverberations of the NIE and what my colleagues talked about, the fear that the United States was slackening in its resolve to confront the rising threat from Iran. It's ironic, of course. There's a lot more that we want them to do on Iran, but evidently they want us to prove our bona fides first. In any case, since Annapolis is the headline, let me make some comments about the Arab-Israeli portion of the trip. First, it will be brief, with few emotive images, few historic moments, and, as I would agree with Bob here, no major push for a diplomatic breakthrough. Only bilateral meetings are scheduled. No trilateral meetings between Israelis and Palestinians are scheduled. In Israel, other than the visit to Yad Vashem, there are only private meetings and meals with the president, with the prime minister. No other major symbolic events, as far as I have come to learn, no other major symbolic events have been planned. The president isn't even meeting with the head of the opposition, Bibi Netanyahu, which is normally traditional in these sorts of high-level trips. But he will be meeting with Arik Sharon's son, Gilad, ostensibly to discuss agriculture and what lessons can be learned from the Sharon farm that the president can take back to Texas. You can't make this stuff up. There are evidently two reasons for this low-key visit. Low-key in terms of the public profile. First, there is an effort to maintain a certain balance between Israel and the Palestinians. The president is going to Jerusalem. He's going to Ramallah. From the very beginning, they ruled out laying a wreath at Arafat's grave. And so in order to be able to do that, he stayed away from almost all symbolic things in Israel, other than Yad Vashem, which is, as I come to understand, is very important to the president. And then secondly, there's also a good chance the president is going to return to Israel in May for Israel's 60th, when a visit that will be, if it comes to pass, will be chock full of all sorts of symbolic events. Now, one of the reasons the president may go back in May is because the prime minister of Israel, Ehud Olmert, is perhaps the president's biggest fan in the world today. Let me just cite this one quotation from Ehud Olmert's interview last week with the Jerusalem Post. Quote, "I don't recall another president who systematically and consistently showed the same level of commitment to Israel as George W. Bush. He's also a great guy. I know that people say all kinds of things about him, but gentlemen," he says to the interviewers, "gentlemen, he's a graduate of Yale and Harvard, and people don't graduate from Yale and Harvard without wisdom and understanding of the processes of domestic and international relationships. He's a very wise man." Quote, unquote. And that might earn Olmert another trip back by the president. Now, more broadly, the president's visit to Israel and to the Palestinian Authority comes against the backdrop of two important issues. One, the NIE in Iran, about which I'll say something in a moment. And secondly, criticism from Secretary of State Rice and even from the president himself of Israeli settlement activity. The former, the NIE, is, I think, a much more significant issue than the latter, or is at least viewed as such, certainly by the Israelis. However we want and should parse the words of the NIE, there is certainly no escaping the political importance to Israelis at the very least, of the U.S. intelligence community reaching a collective statement that Iran no longer has a nuclear weapons program. Among the many implications of this is that it blows out of the water the idea that the U.S. and Israel are in lockstep on Iran, at least on intelligence, if not operationally. Within hours of the NIE, the defense minister, Ehud Barak, was quoted as saying, as far as we Israelis know, Iran has probably revived their nuclear weapons program. Olmert then almost immediately decided to shut down and rein in his ministers and his spokespeople on the topic of the NIE, but there is no mistaking, in my view, that this is a volcano waiting to blow, both in the politics and on the process between the two countries. In terms of process, it was generally assumed that there would be a commitment between the two sides, a commitment to no surprises, a commitment to a full exchange of information, a commitment to the idea that the two parties would have a full-blown intelligence partnership. I think there are numerous statements from various heads of CIA, DNI, about how the Israelis and the Americans are like this on the intelligence on Iran. That's clearly not the case. The politics is unmistakable because it. I think the conventional wisdom on this in terms of the United States is probably accurate, that it removes, at least in the near term, the idea of U.S. military action against Iran. Now, there are many angles of this. Bob and Patrick spoke about some of this. Let me just add the following in terms of my view of the Israeli side. First, we should not assume that the United States and Israel, this is a double negative, we should not assume that the United States and Israel cannot have a serious fight about intelligence on Iran at the same time as they are partners in diplomacy. We should not assume that one means the other is not possible. I only call on you to recall what happened in the 1990s. The Clinton administration and the Israeli government had a vicious, brutal, knockdown, drag-out fight on the Iranian nuclear program and the extent to which the Russians were providing assistance. This went up to the president, the vice president, at the very same moment as they were working hand-in-hand with each other in the Oslo process. These two things can happen at the same time. Second, and I think that there's a good chance that will happen. Secondly, I agree with those who say that one implication of the NIE is that it increases, not decreases, the likelihood of Israeli action. And thirdly, not directly germane to this, but I think important nonetheless, what hasn't been spoken about one item which hasn't been spoken about is that Israel has a certain chit in its pocket as a result of September 6th and what happened in Syria. I'm referring here to the implications for U.S. policy on North Korea. So far, silence from Israel on what they knew about in terms of North Korean nuclear cooperation with Syria, if any, silence by Israel's part on this issue has helped the administration a great deal as it pursues its policy vis-a-vis North Korea. I think that is an enormous chit that Israel has in its pocket for an administration that is putting a great deal of emphasis on a North Korean agreement. Now, move to the other side in terms of the peace process. I urge you to look very closely at the words the president himself is using at the moment to define his own goal for 2008. And here I'll direct you to the interview he did with my TV station, El Hura, just a couple of days ago. Quote, "Do you still believe your vision of a Palestinian state can be achieved before you leave office?" President's response, "I think the outlines, the definition of a state can be achieved. The implementation will be subject to the roadmap. There's a lot of work that has to be done, et cetera, et cetera. But the state will come into being subject to, but the first step is what a state will look like. And I believe we can get that done by time I leave office." Well, there you have a very interesting new wrinkle and American peace process diplomacy. We had the Political Horizon a few months ago. We had Annapolis as the launching of a negotiation with the objective of an agreement within a year to a new form of an agreement that is an agreement on definitions, defining a Palestinian state, borders, powers, limitations of sovereignty, etc., whose implementation will come only after all roadmap obligations are fulfilled. It's that sort of agreement, not an agreement that would ever be fulfilled, an agreement that might not be fulfilled for many, many years, that Bush believes may be possible in 2008. Now, there's a certain attraction to what you might call a shelf agreement. On the plus side, it has the benefit of separating diplomacy from reality. Reality in terms of what the parties can themselves do on the ground. So far, up until now, the president himself has substituted for this inability of the parties to make movement themselves. He's substituted himself by making his own personal commitments. So, for example, Palestinian leaders rule out recognizing Israel as a Jewish state, despite the original partition resolution defining Israel as such. So Bush bends over backwards, as he did at Annapolis, to not only recognize Israel as a Jewish state, but as the homeland of the Jewish people, which is, in fact, a step further than that. Palestinians haven't budged from the demand for the 67 borders. Bush compensates for that to Israel with the Sharon letter, saying, essentially, 67 plus. Now, at some point, Bush can't continue compensating for this disagreement. And the game has to move to the parties reaching their own agreement. That is what's involved in a shelf agreement by the end of the year. But if this is the positive side, it separates reality from diplomacy. The negative side is that it separates diplomacy from reality. I mean, we've been seeing that lately. President is going to Israel against a backdrop of a very odd symmetry in U.S. government statements. On the one hand, there's been fairly direct criticism of Israeli settlement activity, Har HaChomer apartments as an impediment to peace, but there's been not a word of criticism of the fact that Israeli civilians have been killed by off-duty Palestinian security officials, PA security forces. Now, it's one thing not to equate settlement activity with terrorism, a mistake that a previous administration got itself entangled in. It's even worse, I think, however, to focus exclusively on the problems of settlement activity and not at all on the unsolved problems of PA security. So I think that is an unreal aspect of what's going on in Washington the last few weeks. The second problem with just focusing on a shelf agreement is that the conditions for implementation are sure to break down if the agreement is reached. Indeed, that may be the strategy, that the way to circumvent the roadmap is that the roadmap is too hard to do. So you reach a final status deal, the outcome of which would be so appealing, according to this argument, so appealing to the majorities on both sides that you merely get them to sweep aside the requirements of the roadmap. I know that this is attractive to some on both sides, some Israelis and some Palestinians. My sense is that events on the ground are not going to let this happen. At the very least, for example, the Qassams. The Qassams are just not going to let a theoretical agreement between Israelis and Palestinians on final status, are not going to let leaders merely brush aside the immediacy of security. We saw last week a Qassam hitting Ashkelon. The expansion of the radius of Israelis vulnerable is now huge, and I think that before long the pressure will be too big for an Israeli government to withstand. The shelf agreement also, I should say, it suggests that the parties, in fact, may even be closer to a theoretical agreement than they really are. And here I just point out two issues. The general sense of many people in Washington is that, you know, we know what the agreement is. They were very close 7 years ago. I think that's a much too hasty judgment. And I'll just point out two issues. I'm not even going to focus on security. I'm not even going to focus on territory, rather. One is security, the other is Jerusalem. Whatever agreement that was close in the summer of 2000 now has to be totally rethought, it seems to me, given the experience of the last 7 years. Given the experience of Qassams, given the experience of the second Intifada, given the breakdown of security cooperation, all that now has to filter in to what was on the table in July of 2000. And then on Jerusalem, people tend to forget that this isn't only about territory, it's about people. It's about people. A very interesting study was done by the sort of left-leaning Jerusalem Institute for Israel Studies last month, reported on last month, which noted that there are 200,000 Arab Jerusalemites with Israeli citizenship cards, who, according to most ideas of an agreement, would find themselves in neighborhoods in a new Palestinian state, almost none of whom would want to live in a new Palestinian state. Is it the idea that these people would merely have their citizenship transferred against their will to a Palestinian state? Or would Israel lose the land but have to keep the people? Probably the worst of all outcomes from an Israeli perspective. I just think that there are a lot more details than we on the surface give credit for. In any case, I think there'll be little movement on much of this during the president's trip. There is, of course, a lot of movement in Israel itself. Ehud Olmert is the really the comeback kid of Israeli politics. He gets bolder and bolder every day. He doesn't fear the Winograd Report. He gets his budget passed faster and easier than any previous Israeli prime minister in memory. He smiles when Lieberman and Shas say they're going to bolt the government. And he persists in making remarkable public statements, moving him from being a Jabotinskyite hawk to being almost a leftist dove for the 21st century. It's a remarkable move for Ehud Olmert. The Bush trip strengthens him in some respects. It pushes the Winograd Report to the end of January when it might have come earlier, and he gets the benefit of being viewed as somebody who might be able to withstand the political repercussions of that report. Just a couple of more brief points. As Patrick said, the peace process is going to come up in the Gulf. If I could just synopsize my own view, there is progressive defensiveness, even squeamishness, on the part of the administration in dealing with Arab states regarding to the peace process. Let me remind you the following. Just as Annapolis was happening, the Secretary of State outlined a formula, which was this. Israel was accepting a new equation of peacemaking, which changed the sequence. It made negotiations of final status coterminous with implementation of the roadmap. In return, the American side suggested, the Arabs needed to accept a similarly changed sequence, which would have made normalization with Israel progressive, but also coterminous with implementation of with negotiations and implementation of the roadmap. That the Arabs were going to move their sequence just the way the Israelis moved their sequence. Well, Washington got completely stiffed on the issue. The Saudis said, no way. No Arab Gulf state has uttered a word in terms of movement on this issue, and the administration has effectively dropped it. If you look at the president's statements about this issue, he praised, quote, my good friend King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia just for sending his foreign minister to Annapolis, where he refused to shake the hand of the Israelis, as though that in and of itself was the bona fides of peacemaking. Secondly, while all attention has been made on this part of the Arab-Israeli portion, I think we haven't focused enough about the last part of the president's trip, the last stop in Sharm el-Sheikh to see President Mubarak. And here, let me just take a moment. I think this is an extremely important meeting. Mubarak hasn't been to Washington in years. In a strategic sense, I believe his regime is already in transition. Exactly to what is not clear. Tactically, very odd and very dangerous things are happening. Egyptian-Israeli relations, never warm, are near their most bellicose in many years. Last week, Egypt blatantly violated its understanding with Israel by opening the border at Rafah. Foreign Minister of Israel attacks Cairo in terms you've rarely heard before. Foreign Minister of Egypt responds by saying we're going to work against Israel's interests around the world. This is a very serious development. On regional issues, the burden of that internal transition seems to have fallen like a wet blanket over Cairo, which doesn't seem to have the energy to play a regional role with any vigor or energy. And the problem for America is that Egypt's important. Important for peacemaking, important on Iraq, important on Iran, but Egypt appears adrift. Now let me quote just on this from an article that appeared a couple of days ago from the chairman of the Egyptian Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee, writing in El Ahram. Quote, "Indeed, Cairo disagrees with the United States on most major issues related to the Middle East. It refused wholehearted support for Washington's position over Lockerbie, over the invasion of Iraq, and against Iran. It opposed attempts to isolate Syria and has grave reservations over Darfur. Anyone who believes the U.S.-Egyptian relationship is founded on an identical outlook and shared policies is detached from reality." Now, normally when a president comes on the eve of a visit, the message is, despite our problems, we have a strong partnership. Here, the message in El Ahram was, despite the image of a partnership, we have profound and deep-seated problems. So don't mistake this partnership for anything real. I think that's a very serious message. Which brings me to my last point. From the opening press release that I referred to earlier from the White House about this trip, to the president's El Hura interview and others, one word is glaring by its omission, and that's democracy. I think it is no coincidence that the president is meeting President Mubarak in Sharm el-Sheikh. When the Secretary of State goes to Cairo, she has to meet with liberals and reformers. You don't have to do that in Sharm el-Sheikh. Privately, the president does continue to do this. He just met a couple of weeks ago with Mamoun Homsi, a very prominent and courageous and brave Syrian. He's at great length, he met with him in the White House. But I don't see him doing that much of this on this trip, regrettably, and not in public. My own view, and my colleagues may disagree, but that my own view is that robust action on that front actually increases the likelihood of partnership with various regional states on security-related issues, not decreases it. And I would be much happier if he doesn't just make a surprise visit to Iraq or to Lebanon, but he makes a surprise meeting with some of the liberals and reformers that are still willing, believe it or not, to associate themselves with the president. And I think the president and the White House would be surprised how many liberals and reformers around the region would still welcome an invitation from President George W. Bush to meet with him, even in the soil of the Middle East. Thank you very much.